Hello, and welcome to the second episode of MJA Podcast for 2014. This is Zane Colling, Editorial Assistant at the MJA. Today's episode focuses on the field of infectious diseases and one of the scourges of the 20th century. Professor David Cooper, Director of the Kirby Institute for Infection and Immunity in Society at UNSW, sits down with Kate Swinnell, and together they reflect on the history of the HIV and AIDS pandemic. They review the turning point in the treatment of disease, from a death sentence to chronic illness. They also take a look at the current data, including the worrisome increase in rate of infection in Australia, and what factors might be causing this trend. Finally, they round off the discussion with the future of the disease, what treatment options are currently being researched, including the exciting world of vaccination, and whether a cure is practicable.
This is Kate Swinnell for the Medical Journal of Australia. Welcome to the latest in our series of Centenary Year podcasts. Our very special guest today is Professor David Cooper, Director of the Kirby Institute for Infection and Immunity in Society at the University of New South Wales. Welcome, Professor Cooper, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Kate.
You've been there since the beginning of the HIV/AIDS issue. It's 30 years now, a little over 30 years since it was first identified. Where are we in Australia in terms of where HIV/AIDS treatment and prevalence is going?
Right, so the changes in HIV since the time we saw our first cases in the early to mid 80s have been just extraordinary. In the 1980s and the early 1990s, we had no antiviral therapy. We had no treatments apart from some impact on the various opportunistic infections.
Mm-hmm.
So people came in with an opportunistic infection, pneumocystis pneumonia or Kaposi sarcoma. We treated them for that. They sometimes got better, and then they had a honeymoon period of, maybe 6 months, maybe a year, and then the second infection would come along, and then they'd progressively deteriorate and die.
Yeah.
And that was a common pattern all over the globe. At St. Vincent's Hospital, where I was in charge of the HIV unit at the time. At any one time, we had 30 patients under our care in the early 90s who were all sick and dying.
Mm.
And that was a pretty horrendous experience. And for all my colleagues around the world, whether it was in North America or Europe or Asia or wherever, it was the same horrible experience.
When was the turnaround?
So the first antiretroviral drugs came through in the late 1980s. By 1993, we had the results of what was called the Concord study, where giving AZT early had no impact compared to giving it late. So that was a very disappointing outcome. So the next thing that happened, which was really quite fascinating, was that the American AIDS Clinical Trials Group, sponsored by the National Institutes of Health, set up a trial of AZT monotherapy in HIV-infected pregnant women.
Right.
To try and prevent the babies becoming infected. That trial was incredibly controversial. To the great perseverance and community consultation of the AIDS Clinical Trials Group, they got the trial finished, and it was absolutely amazing. It reduced perinatal transmission down to around 5%, something like that, maybe 5 to 10%. And that was the first bit of evidence that the drug actually did something. It actually worked. By the mid-1990s, 1996, which was the World AIDS Conference in Vancouver, the first trials of the triple therapy had been done. We could measure the virus at that stage by PCR technology. And we were able to show that you could drive the virus to undetectable levels and the immune system would recover with this triple therapy. And that was the turning point, so that from 30 patients in the ward in 1992 or 1993, the ward just emptied out.
Yeah.
And it was a Lazarus effect, and that was everywhere in the everywhere in rich countries that could afford the treatment. So that was really a remarkable outcome. So from the one-way traffic to the hospice, we were getting one-way traffic back to work. And back to normal lives.
So if you receive a diagnosis of HIV positive today, you're looking at a chronic illness.
Yes.
With a handful of pills.
Yes.
Every day.
Yes.
Do you think that's a factor in the, I think there was a 10% increase in 2012 in the number of HIV cases, is that correct?
Right.
Do you think that change from an acute fatal illness to a chronic illness has changed the attitudes of the younger people?
Right, so there's no doubt that that's one of the major factors. It may not be the only factor, but it's one of the major factors. It's in the social research context, it's known as treatment's optimism. So before, when it was clearly a fatal illness, people were very afraid of having sex, afraid of sharing needles and so on and so forth, and so they, you know, there was less transmission. With the new treatments, the people are well, and so that they feel well and they feel good, and when people feel well and good, they have sex. You know, if we didn't have sex, it'd be the end of the human race, right?
Yes.
So that's a good thing, right? Mm-hmm. And that has been an excellent outcome. When people feel well, they're more likely to take risks.
Yes.
Because they know it's not going to be a fatal illness for them, that there's going to be a treatment, and the treatments are relatively simple and relatively well tolerated, although you have to take medication for the rest of your life.
Does HIV have an effect on other chronic illnesses that people may...
Yes, so it certainly does. So we know now that people with HIV in rich countries who don't have drug use risk factors have an almost normal life expectancy. But there is a certain period of time shaved off. It's probably 5 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Shaved off a normal life expectancy. So if in rich countries right now, people live to an average of around 80, slightly more for women, slightly less for men, there's 5 to 10 years shaved off so that you can give someone a life expectancy of around 70. What's the reason for that, that gap? The reason for the gap is that there is an increased rate of what we call serious non-AIDS illnesses.
Mm.
And these are essentially non-communicable diseases. So they're essentially cardiovascular disease, an increased rate of cancer, an increased rate of diabetes, an increased rate of renal disease, and an increased rate of liver disease.
Are the mechanisms of that clear?
Yes, the mechanisms are pretty clear, that even if they're not fully worked out, but what is clear is that the virus is still there, it is still pro-inflammatory, and just like in, say, rheumatoid arthritis or lupus, as chronic inflammatory conditions, that ongoing inflammation, which is set up by HIV as well as the autoimmune diseases, causes this increased rate of inflammation in blood vessels and the pancreas and so on, giving you heart disease and diabetes.
Is it realistic to hope for a cure?
Look, we're always optimistic about these sort of things. Mm. So there are in terms of the global control of the HIV epidemic, I think the first thing we need if we're going to have a substantial impact is a vaccine.
Yeah.
We're rolling out antiretroviral therapy. We're now up to about 8 or 9 million people globally, which is absolutely incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Out of about the 30 million people who are HIV infected. But that is not sustainable in the long term. You can't have a sustainable healthcare system that people require to take medicine every day of their lives once they become HIV infected.
Right.
So we desperately need a vaccine. And we know that for any infectious disease, the best public health impact is with vaccination, whether that's a flu or tetanus or whooping cough or whatever.
Yeah.
Having said that, it is not unreasonable to look for a cure. The advances in medical science are extraordinary. Who would have thought that 20 years following the discovery of a really horrible, vile virus, that we had a treatment that made people live almost normal life expectancy. So there's reasons to be optimistic, and science and medical science advances very rapidly, and it may be possible that we will have some sort of genetic engineering that would excise the virus out of your DNA. Having said that, there is no DNA virus, right, that
yeah.
we've been able to cure, right? So if
yep.
you take herpes, still lives in the neurons. If you take chronic hepatitis B, still lives in the liver, even though it is suppressed with antiviral, anti-hepatitis viral drugs.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, a virus like hepatitis C is curable because it's an RNA virus and doesn't
Not
get into the genes.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of work to be done, but I think we should do the work. The point, however, is that while all that amazing work is happening and trying to find the vaccine or the cure, we have to treat people.
Yeah.
We're doing a very good job in low and middle income countries. We have been able to harness healthcare systems to roll out this treatment. This was something that was never possible 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing system.
Have the pharmacological companies come to the party now?
So at the moment, the costs in rich countries is around, $10,000 a year for innovator drugs, which is probably fair enough in terms of the R&D and recovering their costs.
Mm-hmm.
The generic supply in many of the drugs is now available. We can get combinations in low and middle income countries for $50 a year.
Do we have an obligation as a developed nation to pay some of that cost for our neighbours?
So absolutely, we do. So so there are two main mechanisms for funding the rollout in low and middle income countries. One is called PEPFAR, which is the President's Emergency Plan for the Relief of AIDS,
mm-hmm.
which is $1 billion a year, many billion dollars a year program that was set up by the previous President George Bush and continued by President Obama,
mm-hmm.
And that has treated several million people, particularly in Africa.
Yep.
And now that's being handed over. It's sort of rolling back a little bit, but completely, and is being handed over to the countries to take responsibility. The second system was the Global Fund for HIV, TB and malaria.
Yep.
That also has been very active in the rollout. We in Australia contribute to the Global Fund. I don't think we contribute enough. Our overseas development assistance is not what it should be. We should be giving, we should be ramping up to the 0.7% as was promised by Prime Minister Rudd. But because of all sorts of, you know, other factors, we're still down in the, you know, 0.3 to 0.5% range. And, you know, this would make, if we could increase our ODA, not only to HIV, but, you know, other health areas, as well as all the other aid programs of roads and, you know, agriculture and so on, that would make an enormous difference to our neighbours. We have the epidemic in our region is very, very different to Africa. The epidemic in Africa is a generalised epidemic, where men and women are equally affected.
Right.
In our region, it is a concentrated epidemic, and it's a concentrated epidemic amongst vulnerable populations. And those vulnerable populations are gay men, particularly young gay men in Asia. They are sex workers, particularly female sex workers, all over Asia. They are injectors all over Asia. And they're the clients of sex workers and their regular female partners.
Right.
Usually the wife or the you know, the ongoing partner. And that concentrated epidemic is very hard to break into. And it's very hard to break into because these are vulnerable people. And in particularly in many of these countries, there's stigma and discrimination against sex work and against being homosexual, and so it's hard to get into those populations. But some countries are doing a good job, but we need to, you know, we need to do a lot more in our region to get these vulnerable people onto treatment.
Does that stigma make this a harder thing to eliminate than, say, smallpox or polio?
You know, yes and no. If countries have laws which promote stigma and discrimination, then it's hard for people to come forward and to be tested, right?
Yeah.
So if being gay is outlawed or it's stigmatized, or doing sex work is, you know, is the same sort of thing, then that is difficult, and it makes those populations hard to reach. And if there's laws against that in some societies, that makes it very difficult. On the other hand, if the society says, well, you know, it's better to engage those communities and not have them being vulnerable, then we can get into them and we can do a lot of good.
Coming back home again, do you... Is there a need to, in a sense, re-educate the younger generations coming through?
Yeah, right. So that's a very important point. So, you know, go back to 1993, you know, with my ward of 30 people sick and dying. All their friends visited, all their families visited. It was pretty clear what was going on. It was very scary, very horrible.
Yeah, I remember.
So now all the treatments happen, all these people are living very normal lives. If you're a young person and you get HIV now, you know, you'll go on to treatment with before your immune system is badly affected, and you'll do well. So, but your friends and your family and your close ones won't see the impact of HIV on your life. So a young gay man, whether, you know, in any gay city in the world, whether it's London or Berlin or San Francisco or Amsterdam or Sydney or Melbourne, they're not going to see people who are sick and dying.
Yeah.
That's in a sense is a real problem. I mean, it's a good thing, but it means that our approach to HIV has to be different. And I think what the community's doing right now and what the New South Wales and Victorian governments are doing is in collaboration with the community-based organisations is a really good thing. So step back, one of the most important trials of the last 5 years was HPTN 052. It was science article of the year about 2 or 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it showed that treating someone with HIV who didn't need treatment for their own health prevented transmission to their partner.
Right.
And so I think the campaigns now are about, taking responsibility and going on to treatment to protect your community, right?
Yeah.
Now, it's not forcing people to go on to treatment. If someone has a good CD4 count of 500 or something, they don't need treatment. But should they want to protect their partner, then there's no reason why they can't have treatment. Particularly because it's easy to take. It's now a combination, one pill once a day with, 3 or 4 drugs in it,
mm-hmm.
And the side effects are minimal. So those sort of campaigns are starting to be implemented and hopefully will take effect and will, may have a reduction in the new infection rate.
We've come a long way from the Grim Reaper ads, haven't we?
We certainly have.
Amazing stuff. Alrighty. Anything else you want to focus on? Anything that Kirby Institute is looking at specifically over the next few years?
Yeah. So I think what the Kirby wants to do is try to get so we're a research organisation, and I think what we need to understand is how do we get more people tested, more people onto treatment in Australia and in our region. Right? And so what are the reasons, what are the factors which would improve treatment uptake, treatment maintenance and prevention of transmission? What is the level of treatment, uptake that we would need to have an impact on the overall community HIV to turn around the number of new cases.
Are you finding the political climate friendly?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that we have the World AIDS Conference in Melbourne this year,
yep.
So that's always important to have legacies from that. There is no doubt that New South Wales Health Minister Skinner and Victorian Health Minister Davis are incredibly supportive of the HIV treatments agenda and trying to turn around the new infections. And it's a great credit to them and their advisors and their health departments that they're able to do this.
Terrific. Thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks.
So this would be an appropriate occasion to wish the MJA a very happy birthday. I guess that was one of the things when I did my postdoc in Boston at Harvard in 1981, just when the AIDS epidemic was breaking. That one of the things that always reminded me of medicine at home was going to the library at Harvard Medical School and seeing the latest copy of the MJA.
And there we were.
And there you were. So you did get a little bit of news from home.
Terrific.
And that was the pre-internet days, of course.
Fantastic. Thank you.
That was Professor David Cooper on the HIV and AIDS epidemic. Join us next time as we delve into the field of pain management with Professor Michael Ashby, Director of Palliative Care at the Royal Hobart Hospital. If you have any queries or comments, don't forget to contact us at mja@mja.com.au or join our Facebook or Twitter pages and contact us there. Until next time, this is Zane Colling for the Medical Journal of Australia.